first time in the history of motion pictures comes a story that ignores all conventions, exposes morals, and does irreparable harm to the medical profession. Carry on Matron. It's dynamite when your favorite laughter makers get together again in their own brand of medical madness.
Shh, it's all right, don't scream.
What do you want?
Well, it's very nice of you, but I haven't got the time.
Sidney James, a crook who started at the bottom and stayed there.
Oh.
Kenneth Williams, head of a hospital where it's always wet and windy.
He must have a knee.
I think he's just had one.
Oh, hello.
And as usual, covered in confusion, Charles Hawtrey. Joan Sims, as an expectant mother who's never heard of a food-free diet.
Well, now, you're 3 weeks overdue, and your husband's getting very impatient.
Well, he can talk. Took him 7 years to get me pregnant.
Patty Jakes, the matron, who's not quite with it, but can't do without it.
Certainly not! It's just that I'm a simple woman with simple tastes, and I want to be wooed.
Oh, you can be as wooed as you like with me.
Oh, come back, I want you.
God, she's a sex maniac.
What a carry-on matron. Bernard Breslau, laboring under a strange misconception.
Oh, Mr. Madison.
Just shows you the power of suggestion.
What are you talking about?
Well, I could have sworn I felt it kicking just then.
Kenneth Cope, who took a turn for the nurse. Barbara Windsor, a nurse to raise your hopes and your temperature.
Around here, we call him the taxidermist.
Are you sure? There's nothing like advertising.
Oh, I didn't mean that. Get off! Get away! Take your hands off!
A doctor who wanted everything on the National Health. Terry Scott.
God, what a woman.
Kenneth Connor, as the railway porter whose wife is like his trains. Always late. Carry on Matron, produced by Peter Rogers, directed by Gerald Thomas. The master craftsman of comedy is guaranteed to give you the laugh of a lifetime if you don't die laughing.
Oh, damn it, there's millions of them, man. Damn it!
Oh, wait.
Is she at it then?
Could you get me the Guinness Book of Records?
Now, come on, stop messing about.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Likes of Us podcast with me, your host Neil Bradley, dedicated to working class life, art, politics and culture. Okay, you find me back in the old mobile recording studio. Just set off on my journey to deepest, darkest Bermondsey for a Tuesday night match, Millwall versus Swansea, which I could do without, I've got to tell you. Freezing cold today. So yesterday, as you would have heard on last week's podcast, when I mentioned that my aunt had died, that's my mum's sister. Yesterday, we went to her funeral. Now, I think I'd said in last week's episode that we weren't that close and I hadn't seen her many times since my mother died. We took my dad with us because he's sort of old school, you know, even though he really wasn't well enough to go. And of course he was everything that I probably expected it would be. It was very melancholy and very sad and very nostalgic. Midway through the service they showed a film of my aunt's life with photographs, and I appeared in that film a few times. Young cherubic self, pictures of us at holiday camps and at weddings, this little blonde thing, you know, angelic. One picture in particular that struck me was of me sort of stood next to my granddad Joe, my maternal grandfather. And whilst everyone was sort of smiling at this little blonde kid that was once me, I couldn't help think that I resembled my granddad more with the glasses and the grey hair and the bald head, you know. Yeah, very strange. It was like a strange old affair. Now, the funeral really followed on after a bad week last week. Now, no doubt if you heard last week's episode, which was woefully out of date and overdue, you would have quickly realised just how sort of morose and melancholy that episode was going to be, and so it proved. And I think by the end of it, because it took me the best part of 2 months to actually record it and get it out, by the time I pressed the upload button, I was pretty exhausted from this sort of long month we'd had in terms of like my dad not being well, this like sort of 12, 13 day stint he had in the hospital, and these constant arguments. And I'd said, you know, how a paramedic had come to my dad's house and had made that statement, that damning statement, that my dad was too unwell to go back into that hospital. Well, last Monday, I was just on my way to work, just walking out the door, when the phone rang, and it was my dad again to say that he wasn't feeling well. So I popped along, because he's only like 9 doors away from me, and I had to say, like, he didn't look well sitting in the armchair. So I'd said, you know, are you that unwell that I need to call an ambulance? And he said that he thought perhaps it was best that I did. Now, the day previous I'd gone in, and he was in a similar sort of state, and then I just made him just go back to bed, because he's sort of sleeping on the sofa at the moment. So I just put him back in his bed, and I said I'll come back in a couple of hours. And he seemed to, that seemed to sort of do him good, you know, that rest. And he seemed to rally somewhat. But then the next day, we're back in the same position again. So I called an ambulance. Now, we didn't have to wait that long, about 40 minutes. And I like sort of was foolishly thinking that, you know, maybe it won't be too bad today. What would it be? I'm like a Monday morning going to the hospital. The paramedics came, very nice as always, very attentive. And they sort of give us the usual spiel, really, that they weren't unduly worried, but at the same time, why take a risk? So they would take him to hospital. And we had the same thing again, you know, I said, like, you know, it's Queen Elizabeth. And they said, yeah, and I was explaining, like, you know, like the horror story of his previous stay in Queen Elizabeth and all of the other stays in Queen Elizabeth and all of the other times we've gone to Queen Elizabeth. But it puts them in an awkward position, because that's the closest hospital and they're ordered to take him there. So we went to Queen Elizabeth. Now, when we pulled up in the ambulance bay, there was only one ambulance there, which is normally a good sign. But when we opened the back of the ambulance, the previous paramedic from the ambulance that was already there came out and said he'd been waiting for 20 hours and that there were no beds. So one of the paramedics said, we'll go and get a wheelchair because there's no beds available, because we can't use the bed that he's on in the ambulance. Then they came back and said, apparently all of the wheelchairs have been stolen, which sort of gives you a good indication of what that hospital was like, and gives you probably a good indication of where this story's going, unfortunately, and where it seemed to have gone on all of the previous occasions. So they said, well, we'll use our chair and we'll take him through. But when we got into like the emergency room, we were just like waved straight through into like the casualty department with like the sort of general population, what I describe as like the general population of like low life, unfortunately. So my dad was just put in a chair, and they, you know, the paramedics said, like, you know, we're aware of the fact that, you know, the hospital are aware of the fact that he's here with a suspected heart attack, as always. And I had said to him, like, you know, if I'd known you was going to dump him here, I wouldn't have called the ambulance in the first place, or I certainly wouldn't have let you take him by ambulance to this hospital. And they were a little bit sheepish and a little bit shamefaced, so they left us, and then we just waited, and it was like a scene of chaos. There wasn't a chair to be had. My dad wasn't too well at all. Now, over in the corner, a part of the casualty department had been roped off, and 4 police officers were guarding a man in handcuffs who'd been arrested and was on his way to a police station to be charged, but he'd pulled the I'm not well routine. And across the way from him was a woman who looked the worse for wear, who'd also been arrested but had pulled the I've taken an overdose stroke. So they had to wait there for blood tests, like some kind of scam, you know, and they were kicking off. Then a woman came in with obviously like mental health problems, screaming and shouting. And she came round with like these two, like, I don't know, like psychiatric staff, and then attempted to attack the police, and then come and hovered over my dad, who really wasn't well. So I sort of told her that she needed to fucking move, you know. And then a guy next to me, like this African guy, he said, oh, like, can't you see that she's very sick? And I said, I don't care. Like everybody else here, she's a cunt. And he laughed nervously. And I don't think I was too far off in terms of the descriptions. So I waited a couple of hours. Nobody saw my dad. So I went and asked, you know, what's going on. And then got into an argument with a nurse who said, well, he's not special. Everybody's waiting. And I said, well, I said, there's lots of people waiting with like fake illnesses and sprained ankles, but he's been brought in with a suspected heart attack. So she was sulking a little bit, but she went and got another nurse, so they called my dad in. And we had the same old thing again, you know, so what's happening with you, you know? And I said, like, immediately, like, well, do you not read the notes? Because every time, well, we've called a paramedic or called an ambulance over this last year, 14 months, they've always taken extensive notes, and they've also found all of his records from various hospitals. So they have complete access to everything. We always give them permission to look at all of the medical records. We have like an extensive pile of like old ECGs, which are always really helpful to them to see. And she said, well, why don't you explain it to me? You know, and I said, well, just like read the note. And it's really just a case of like, she wants to know his date of birth, and I don't know. So she told us to go back out and wait, and a doctor will see him. And of course we go out and we wait another 3 hours for a doctor to see him. Then she says to me, the doctor, yeah, so I'm gonna send your dad for an X-ray, a chest X-ray, because we don't know whether he's having a heart attack or not. So if you take him to the X-ray department. And I said, would you mean taking to the X-ray department? Like, are you expecting him to walk? I said, because this morning he couldn't walk across the living room floor. So she said, well, you should have asked for a wheelchair. I said, we did ask for a wheelchair and they've all been stolen. So again, I asked for the PALS team to be informed and come. Like, immediately that signals that, you know, you get red flagged. I mean, I think we were red flagged anyway as being agro merchants. So she said, I'll go and find one. Well, she went missing for about half hour, because it took her half hour to find a track down a wheelchair. So she said, you'll have to take him. And I said, like, it's fine. And I said, but I'm not bringing him back in this fucking room. Because it was like a field hospital in Vietnam. So she said, well, just wait in this corridor and I'll come and find you, you know. So my dad goes and has the X-ray. He'd already had a blood test. And immediately on seeing the first results of the first blood test, he gets taken from there back into the emergency room, where he should have been all along. And we get put in this, like, this room, which obviously held two beds at one time, but we're now was like just working as this, like, it was like the Crimea. The only thing missing was a lady with a lamp. So there was about 13 patients, about 20 of us in all, squeezed into this tiny room with all of the tiles falling off the wall, filthy. And everybody, people being sick in bowls, and a woman slumped in a chair with cancer. And any doctor that came in, like, carried out the consultation in front of everybody, you know, like one patient away. So we heard everybody's business. They heard every bit of our business. And all they kept saying to us that, yeah, they need to go in a bed, but there's just no beds available. And you're waiting for a bed, you know. And yeah, it was just, I don't know, sort of like partly surreal, partly like infuriating, and like partly just like fucking exhausted. And obviously, like, more arguments followed. My niece arrived and she got into an argument with like the sister who came in, and all of the, you know, the people accompanying people that were ill to get out of the chairs. And like she pointed out, you know, my uncle sort of stood here, he's been here for 12 hours standing up, and more or less just told her to sling her up. And then a doctor finally comes and sees us and says that he doesn't really think that my dad's having a heart attack, but he's really worried now about he may have a blood clot because his leg is swollen up, and cannulite in his arm, the blood had congealed and stopped bleeding. So when they tried to take more blood, they couldn't get no bloods out, which was leading them to suspect that he had a blood clot. Now, I pointed out, I said, like, well, he never came in with the swollen leg. He's got the swollen leg because he's been sat in a chair for 12 hours when he should have been lying in a bed with his feet elevated. I don't know, it's just, it's sort of madness, you know. So he said his, like, potassium levels are really low. And I said, of course his potassium levels are really low. You've not fed anybody. You've not even offered them a glass of water. We couldn't feed him because we were waiting for you to confirm whether or not he'd had a heart attack and whether or not he was going to have to go for surgery. So he was sort of like nil by mouth. Yeah, it's just like infuriating, the whole thing. So he said, well, he needs to have some potassium put into him and we're going to put him on a drip. The drip, we've never saw the drip. Even to this day, I've not seen the drip, which I don't know whether that's a blessing or a curse, because the last time he was in the hospital and they put him on a drip and they said that he needed to go on a bag, you know, of 1 litre or whatever it is, whatever the measurements are. They end up putting in 3 times as much and added to his complications. So we didn't really have a lot of faith in their ability. And then he ordered that my dad would need like blood thinning injections just because they were worrying that he had a blood clot. Now that was administered in his stomach in front of everybody else in this little room, you know. And each doctor who was looking after sort of respective patients kept coming in and promising them they was going to have the next bed. So everybody was arguing over who was going to get the bed. And it got to the point where I said, like, I couldn't have your attention because a bed came past, an empty bed. And I said, we're going to have a raffle, £10 a ticket, and whoever wins gets the bed. And of course, like, the doctors and the nurses, they were not happy with that statement, because it was so absurd. So my dad eventually got a bed at 1 o'clock in the morning, bearing in mind that we stepped out of an ambulance at 11 o'clock the previous day. He'd had another of these injections in his stomach for the blood thinning. And the doctor said to us that, look, he needs to have a scan to check whether he's got a blood clot or not, but the scan department is closed and won't reopen again till the morning. And he said, now, your dad could go home and you could bring him back tomorrow as an outpatient, but I'd rather have him stay in the hospital to be on the safe side. So we agreed to that. So I left him, you know, 1, 2 o'clock in the morning. Went back the next day, and for the whole day, no scan. So the evening, I went back and forth, and then in the evening, I arrived and like my brother arrived and said, oh, like, you know, to like the sister in charge, as he had his scan. And she said, no, the porter's never come to collect him. So I said, okay, what do you mean the porter's never come to collect him? Well, they meant to come and collect him. She said, well, I don't know. I said, well, did they order the porter to come and collect him? She said, I don't know. I said, well, what, like, do you know? She said, it's nothing to do with me. You have to go and see someone else. I said, because I've been up 3 times and I could have took him for his scan. So she just was then refusing to speak to us because she didn't like her attitude. So I said, okay, who do I speak to? So she took me around and this like matron. So I said, like, is there a doctor available? No, all the doctors have gone home. They all finish at 5 o'clock. I said, okay. Like, he's meant to have a scan. Yeah, it's closed. So it's closed, isn't it? Yeah, it closes at 6 o'clock. So it's about 7 o'clock now. So the doctors have all gone home. The scan that he's meant to have, he's been waiting 2 days for now. He's not had. No. So I said, like, the chief executive of the hospital, do you know their name? And they didn't know the name of the chief executive. And I said, oh, well, are they in the building? Well, if they are, they would have gone home. I said, okay. Anybody else? Well, there is a site manager of the hospital. I said, okay, the site manager. No, they've gone home. So I said, is there a night manager? I'm not sure. So I said, so who's in charge of the hospital of an evening? They didn't know. And then the manager says, look, is this about patient care? And I said, well, of course it's about patient care. It's not about the food. And she said, look, I don't quite understand what you want. I said, what I want the chief executive or the hospital administrator to be brought to my dad's bed. And she said, what do you mean? I said, I want them brought here. I want them brought back to the hospital because we want to speak to them. Because, like, the hospital is, like, failing in its duty of care once again, you know. So that they looked at us as though we were completely insane rather than the other way around, unfortunately. So eventually this like young guy came, and he was just like an auxiliary nurse, and he just said like, I'm going to go and ring the guy who does the scans. He's gone home, but I'm going to ring him at home. And I said, like, yeah, okay, all right, yeah. And he said, no, I'm going to go and ring him now. So he came back about 15 minutes later and said, like, no, he's gone home. He said, but I spoke to him, and they start at 10 o'clock, but he's agreed to come in the morning at 9 o'clock. I'll be here early. I'll get your dad, and I'll take him personally for this scan. I said, oh, okay. I said, look, you're not just saying this because, like, we're not going anywhere. We are coming back. No. I will definitely sort it. So I rang the next day, and he'd had the scan. So I went back in the evening, and this same nurse, the one we'd had the first argument with, she said, oh, your dad's had his scan. I said, okay, so has it been reviewed? And she went, well, I don't think so. So we go through it. Okay, so you need to go and get me the chief executive of the hospital. I said, what do you mean it's not been reviewed? So this young guy comes around again. He said, oh, you know, he got his scan. I said, yeah, but it's not been reviewed. What's the point of having the scan if he's not been reviewed? So he said, I'll go and get the doctor. So a doctor comes to see me, and she says, hey, you'd be pleased to know there's no blood clot. I said, that's great. That's really good news. She said, but we're really worried now about his kidneys. So I said, oh, right, okay. What's wrong with his kidneys? Well, we think we've been giving him so much blood thinner injection that it's now affected his kidneys. So I said, oh, okay, all right, so you've given him so much blood thinner medication that it's affected his kidneys, but you've given him blood thinner medication because you was worried that he was having a blood clot, which could have been ruled out if he'd had the scan the day previous and somebody actually had reviewed it. And she just sort of walked away. Again, it's like, I don't know. You could fucking take hostages. You really could. The place is, it's just like, I don't know, it's just like a farce, you know. The whole place is like, I don't know. I know they're under the cosh, and I know there's like, there's not a lack of funding, but they're just so fucking disorganised. And I think I've said it before, like, it needs the army or somebody to come in and see them, show them where they're sort of going wrong, you know. So my dad ended up staying in for 4 days, just so to recover from, I mean, it's an irony, because it was a similar story the last time he went in, was that he goes in with a suspected heart attack, it proves not to be the case, but then waits so long in a chair that his legs swell up and ends up with like a suspected blood clot, and then gets kidney failure as a result of them giving him too many blood thinner injections, as a result of them fearing he had a blood clot, all of which could have been solved by him having like an echocardiogram on the day that we took him in to confirm that he didn't have a heart attack. It was a strange, you know, another strange week, and we sort of laughed, you know, not cheerily, but we laughed at the madness of the fact that the last time my dad was in the hospital, we argued every single day that he should stay in the bed because they was trying to discharge him, and you could see that his health was getting worse and worse with each passing day, and he became more sick than on the day that we brought him in. This time round, we were arguing to get him out of the bed. I don't know, you couldn't. I think this time round, because I think like my nieces and like my research assistant were there as well, so because it's normally really been like my brother and me who have, you know, having sort of like simultaneous fucking heart attacks with the stress of it all, along with my dad. I think they, I'm not saying that they ever thought we were exaggerating, but I think seeing it for themselves, like just how bad it is in there, I think like sent fucking shivers down their spines, you know. And I'd said all along, like you couldn't make this stuff up. You genuinely couldn't make it up. If I wrote it as a script, as a play, I could put it on at the Royal Court, because it was like, I don't know, like kitchen sink drama, British satire at its most cutting edge. So naturally we were sort of pleased to get him home. And now, of course, he's like the aftermath, because, like, you know, for days and weeks afterwards, he's always unwell after. And it's the toll taken from being in the hospital. Yeah, I don't know. Just, you know, I said on last week's episode, you know, we've sort of faced up to the fact that, like, my dad's 87 now and he's got heart failure and he's probably not going to get any better. And all we're trying to do as a family is to make his life as comfortable as possible under the circumstances. And this stuff don't help. But as I said before, it's not just him that suffers. It's sort of all of us, because, like, just the arguing alone and the worry and just, like, the absurd nature of it, it just, because it is like insanity, you know, and you do question your own sanity at the end of it. It just takes, like, such a heavy toll, and it's, like, exhausting, you know, so much so that we were sort of almost pleased to go to a funeral yesterday to get some calm, which again is a sort of damning indictment, I think. So I've just reached deepest, darkest Deptford, and Deptford Park, the traffic wasn't too bad tonight, and I've managed probably to record a whole episode just ranting and raving about my experience and my dad's experience and, like, the insanity. As I mean, I'd said last week, and so I wasn't really joking when I said, you know, if you're unwell, you're seriously unwell, like, don't go to Queen Elizabeth Hospital. You'd be better off waiting till Wednesday and putting yourself out with the bins, you know. And I still pretty much maintain that, and I don't think it is too far from the awful truth. Yeah, exhausting. And as if that weren't bad enough, I've now got to spend 2 hours watching Millwall. I think I must have been really bad in a previous life. So I'm just driving around now looking for a parking spot, and I'll give you more a little bit later on. If anything happens, well, you know me, never quite holding my breath. Yeah, cheers.
Well, live my life and never stop to worry about a thing. Open up and shout it out and never try to sing.
Okay, you find me a couple of hours later, back in the old mobile recording studio, trying to crawl my way through the back of Deptford on my way home, after seeing Millwall nick a 2-1 victory, which was sort of somewhat surprising, given the first half performance, which was sort of dull as dishwater. Bitterly cold night down the Den, to go with my bitterly cold mood, I have to say. Not much else to say, I don't think, on this particular episode of the Likes of Us podcast. Whatever I say in the next 30 minutes on this drive home will be the last of it. So next week on the podcast, I'm going to give you my great New York adventure, because I'm off to New York on Friday. Now, sort of somewhat reluctantly, because I haven't been to New York for more than 30 years. Now, back then, it was still like pre-Giuliani and pre the whole zero tolerance thing. So it was still a pretty dangerous place back then, even though I understand it's not too great as we speak. And I've checked the weather and it's snowing a blizzard in New York, so that should be great. Now, the last time I was there in New York, and one of my sole reasons for going there, well, two reasons really. One was to visit the World Trade Center, which I'd always had a fascination with ever since I saw the opening credits to a little known comedy cop show called Barney Miller, which was always on late at night, and I think was never as funny as I remember it to be. But on the, as I say, come the opening credits, it showed you the sort of New York skyline with the Twin Towers right in the foreground. And then they were right on the edge of the Hudson River, because you probably know that all of the excavation work and the rubble they dug out to build those Twin Towers, they put into landfill and kept extending the island of Manhattan outwards to form the rest of those buildings that became sort of like the World Trade Center sort of city there. So that was like one of my sole motivations for going there, because I was always had a fascination with those buildings. And, you know, went to the top of the buildings when I was there, and pretty much went there every day and went to the top. Unfortunately, the weather was so bad that I never was able to get out onto the roof of the Twin Towers. I went up to the observation deck. Now, I went there in the November, and then I think it was come the January or the February, the first attack on the World Trade Center happened, when a minivan was loaded in the underground car park, packed with explosives. And then that was really one of the first indications of this new terrorist threat from Islamists. Well, that threat came back with a vengeance, as we all know. And ever since those Twin Towers came crashing down, I've never really had any great desire to go there. My view has always been that they should have built the towers up immediately and carried on as best they could, as though nothing had happened, because I think that would have been far more of a show of defiance and resilience. But in their wisdom, they built the Freedom Tower. And of course, every time anybody looks at the Freedom Tower, they know full well the reason it was built. So yeah, it's sort of like a bittersweet return for me. Now, my second reason for going there was Robert De Niro, because I've always been a big De Niro fan. And I've always had a fascination with his films, you know, so watch his films over and over again in a really unhealthy way, especially Taxi Driver, because I got into the stage where I would watch Taxi Driver every day before I went to work, which, believe me, take my word for it, won't do you any good. I was living in my flat at Campbell Green then, and I was definitely Travis Bickle, hence the reason we named our little rescue dog Travis Bickle all those years later. And in the end, I think my research assistant ordered me to stop watching it, because it wasn't doing me any good. I kept standing in the mirror saying, "You talking to me?" You know, wearing an army coat with an array of firearms tucked up my sleeve and a big hunting knife strapped to my leg inside my cowboy boot. So, not good. Although I should say, in doing some research for this podcast and for the trip, I've hunted down a De Niro jacket from a place called Kaufman's, which is like an army surplus, like a famous army surplus store, which I went to when I went there the first time. Kaufman's on 42nd Street. So I'll be going back there. Already made inquiries. Now, back then, I was trying to visit the scenes of Taxi Driver. So we went to, obviously, like Columbus Circle, where he makes an attempt to shoot the senator. But most of the other locations were just really off limits, because I was hunting down the building where he goes and shoots Harvey Keitel and the other like gangster pimps, but it was just too dangerous to go there. In fact, it was pretty dangerous going anywhere. You couldn't really go in Central Park back then, even though we ran through there one morning after going up to see the Dakota building where John Lennon lived and of course was assassinated outside of. The underground you really couldn't go on. We did take a bus tour that took us right uptown across 110th Street up to Harlem to see like the Apollo and the headquarters of the infamous Elijah X, who recruited Malcolm X and Muhammad Ali to his flock. And then it was always rumoured that who ordered the assassination of Malcolm X. And that was a pretty dangerous place, and lots of the locals threw stones at the bus, so we certainly never got off. But I say it was a pretty rough old place then. One day we sort of braved the underground and was going back to the World Trade Center and took the wrong line, and I ended up, we came out of this station and I could see the Brooklyn Bridge down the road, you know. So I thought, we'd gone to the wrong side of Manhattan, gone to the east side rather than like the Battery Park side. But what it turns out, as we walked further down the road and there was like burnt out cars and it didn't feel that. So we was actually in Brooklyn Heights, which now is like a sort of like hipster yuppie area, and you couldn't afford to live there, you know. A bit like many parts of London now, you know. So we had to hot-footed back to the station and get on the tube and go back. So it was a strange old trip that last time. Although we did manage to get to Tribeca Bar and Grill, which was De Niro's restaurant, and had not long been opened. And I think the week we were there, famously, I think Michael Stipe of REM had a date with Morrissey. What a chance of that, I mean. Now that particular area, like Tribeca, which actually means triangle below Canal Street, was a pretty rough old area on 8th Avenue, because it was round by the sort of like the meatpacking district. Now, years ago, that was certainly in like the 70s and the 80s, that became notorious for all of like the gay clubs. Well, not so much the gay club, but more like really the extreme gay clubs, like Heavy Leather and places like the Ramrod and the Anvil. Now, the reason I know all this stuff is not because I'm into the crackle of leather, even though I quite like a leather jacket. They were all clubs that appeared in the film Cruising with Al Pacino, who I was another big fan of. And at the time, I was just really into everything New York. So, like, no surprise that my first trip to America, the first state I ticked off my list was New York. Now, the trip came about because my nan had died and she'd kindly left me £1,000 and with a little note saying, take yourself to New York. She remembered I always wanted to go there. And that's what I did. I booked this trip and I took $1,000 and I come back with $1. And that really started my obsession with like the United States. And now I think I've been to about 33 states in total. But weirdly, like New York has never really sort of called me back. Once I discovered the West Coast, once I discovered San Francisco, that was it for me. And I never ever thought about going back to New York again. Now, my research assistant went there some years back at the time of Hurricane Katrina, and she said it was nice and that I would enjoy it, and the city had become a much safer place then. I mean, it became a much safer place because of like zero tolerance and that like broken window policy that New York adopted. And of course, like, they achieved it by employing an extra 30,000 policemen. And then it had become even, you know, weirdly, after like the 9/11 terror attacks, it became like an even safer, more sanitized place as a result of that. But now, in the same way as San Francisco and Los Angeles and Seattle and Portland, all of those like Democrat cities, all of those cities like are sort of like that are liberal and of the left, despite Trump coming from New York, they all have these major problems in the same way as we do in London, with crime and an unwillingness or reluctance to tackle it, crime, because of sometimes who it might offend, you know, which certainly seems a flawed policy to me. You know, I've spoken about San Francisco often on this podcast, and that liberal approach to crime and drugs, and it just doesn't work, unfortunately. So, yeah, I'm going there in two minds, really, to New York. And I'll obviously take the recorder with me and give you my observations of that city. But I'm just expecting, in many ways, like a colder version of San Francisco. Now, after my last San Francisco trip, last year when I went there for a month, I wasn't put off by San Francisco because I still loved the city and I still would go there tomorrow if I had the financial wherewithal. Like post-COVID, it had turned into a sort of a really dangerous place. I mean, it always had its rough spots and was always a little bit ragged around the edges, always looked like a bit of a dirty city, but the crime was definitely more noticeable in some of the more affluent areas as well, like lots of car crime, lots of like muggings. And it sort of put me off a little bit going there again, even though there are plans now, inevitably, because they've had to do it, of employing more policemen and trying to sort of wage war on crime, because it became a bit like the Wild West, the same as in Los Angeles, which ironically enough, that's where we're going in the summer, Los Angeles, because I've never been there before. So this time round, we've sort of forgone our San Francisco adventure, and instead we've chosen Los Angeles. We've chosen Los Angeles for about 11 days, and then we're going to get a train up the West Coast, past San Francisco, into Oregon and Portland, on to Seattle, another city that is suffering like crime problems and lots of like antisocial behaviour. So I'm obviously like a glutton for punishment. Maybe I've toughened up ever since I've been going in that Queen Elizabeth Hospital. So yeah, looking forward to that. Looking forward is probably not the right description, but whilst I'm there, obviously I'll be going on the Bowie Trail and going to see where he lived and spent the last years of his life, and some of his like favourite hangouts, like bookshops, I've been researching. So interesting to see those places. But I'll give you that in the great New York adventure, when I finally record that and return to dear old Blighty. So I'm just approaching home now, so I'm going to call it a day there. Only slightly more upbeat than last week's episode, but you know me. Anyway, think of us, think of the likes of us, and I repeat the advice I gave you in the last episode. If you're unwell and you need hospital treatment, steer clear of the QE2 hospital in Woolwich, and just wait till Wednesday and put yourself out with the bins. Cheers.
I'll say goodbye to all my sorrow, and by tomorrow I'll be be on my way. I guess the Lord must be in New York City. I'm so tired of getting nowhere, seeing my prayers gone unanswered. I guess the Lord must be in New York City. Well, here I am, Lord, knocking at your back door. Ain't it wonderful to be where I've always wanted to be? For the first time I'll breathe free here in New York City. Say goodbye to all my sorrow, and by tomorrow I'll be on my way. I guess the Lord must be in New York City. First time I'll breathe free here in New York City.